Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
You gave them the old razzle-dazzle. You razzle-dazzled them. You gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe you were compassionate. Gave them
Greetings, this is podcast number 11 of Blast the Right. I'm Jack Clark from therationalradical.com, www.therationalradical.com. The opening music sets us up very nicely for our two segments today. Just like George Bush said, he never stops searching for ways to harm our country, neither does Sean Hannity. One of the worst ways that Hannity harms this country is his use of the big lie technique. We'll talk today about Hannity's use of the big lie propaganda technique in the area of civil rights. Then, shades of George Bush saying that his base is the have-mores. We'll talk about income and wealth inequality in the United States. The statistics you've already heard about it may make it sound pretty unequal. However, in the analysis I'll present, you'll see how the situation is far more obscene than you ever imagined. Let's get into the first segment. I don't listen to Sean Hannity's radio program, only his Hannity and Combs television show. So all my comments are related to what he says on the TV program. He's been repeating something over and over again lately that really gets me annoyed. I'm referring to his big lie about civil rights. If you're a member of Sean Hannity's audience and you don't know anything about history, what is Sean Hannity telling you about the civil rights era? Sean Hannity tells you that it was the Republicans that were responsible for the passage of the Civil Rights Act and other civil rights legislation in the 1960s and in the last half of the 20th century. Hannity harps on the fact that at that time, there were a lot of racist Dixiecrat Democrats who were opposed to the civil rights legislation and that those bills wouldn't have passed unless a lot of Republicans joined in to vote for them. All that's true. But to come out of that with the conclusion that the Republicans are the party of civil rights stands reality on its head, like right-wingers often do. The dividing line during those civil rights legislation votes wasn't Republican or Democrat, as Hannity would have you believe. No, it was liberal versus conservative. Liberal Democrats voted for the civil rights legislation, and so did liberal Republicans. Yes, back then there were liberal Republicans. Conservative Democrats and conservative Republicans voted against the civil rights legislation. The fact of the matter, obviously, is that President Lyndon Johnson, a Texas Democrat, was the one who proposed and pushed through the legislation. Johnson famously said that by passing these bills, these civil rights bills, that the Democratic Party has lost the white vote in the South for a generation or two, and he proved to be correct. Now, did the white vote in the South turn Republican because all these white people decided, oh, we're for civil rights, we're for uplifting the African-American community, so let's go vote for the Republican Party because we don't want to be with the Democrats because they're anti-black? Is that what Sean Hannity is having you believe if you listen to him and take what he says at his word? That's what he's having you believe, which is absurd. The white Southern vote shifted to the Republicans because those white people who shifted were upset because the Democratic Party was supporting civil rights and voting rights for the African American community. That's what happened. Sean Hannity doesn't tell you that. Sean Hannity also does not tell you that a lot of the conservative Democrats who voted against the civil rights legislation switched parties. They became Republicans. Again, they became Republicans because they thought that the racist anti-African American views that they held would be more welcome in the Republican Party, would be more in line with the Republican Party philosophy. That's why they switched from Democrat to Republican. indeed, probably the main thing that Sean Hannity doesn't tell his audience is that there was actually something dubbed the Southern Strategy of the Republican Party in that civil rights era to get the vote of these whites who were upset that the Democrats had lent their support to civil rights and voting rights for African Americans. Hannity likes to brag that the Republicans are the party of Lincoln, but Hannity doesn't tell you that the Republicans switched sides in the civil rights arena in the 60s. The GOP's Southern strategy was devised by, or under at least, none other than Tricky Dick Nixon. Yes, Dick Nixon. And don't let the right winger deny that there was such a thing as a GOP Southern strategy. It's been well documented and admitted and bragged about by mainstream Godfather type figures in the Republican Party who were responsible for devising GOP strategy. In a recent column, Bob Herbert of the New York Times quoted the late Lee Atwater in a 1981 interview explaining how the GOP Southern strategy evolved. If you don't know who he was, Lee Atwater was the grandpappy of all the Republican dirty campaign, dirty tricks, vicious politics of personal destruction campaign strategists. Karl Rove was a disciple of Lee Atwater. Before I read the Atwater quote, let me mention that instead of the racial epithet that rhymes with trigger that Atwater repeatedly uses, I'm going to use the term N-word. This is what Lee Atwater said in that interview. You start out in 1954 by saying N-word, N-word, N-word. By 1968, you can't say N-word. That hurts you. Backfires. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. You're getting so abstract now that you're talking about cutting taxes, and all these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and a byproduct of them is that blacks get hurt worse than whites. This Southern strategy and Lee Atwater are Sean Hannity's political forebears. They're the line of political strategy and belief that Sean comes from. Sean Hannity also worships Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was one of the greatest presidents in American history, according to Sean Hannity. But Ronald Reagan was one of the worst practitioners of the GOP Southern strategy. What's the evidence of that? How about this? True to his beliefs, evidenced by his opposition to both the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of the mid-60s, Reagan began his general election campaign in 1980 with a speech in Philadelphia, Mississippi. Now, why did he go to Philadelphia, Mississippi? What's in Philadelphia, Mississippi that he would go open his campaign for president there? Reagan spoke at the county fair there that day. No presidential candidate had ever spoken at that fair, let alone open their national presidential campaign there. The place where a presidential candidate opens his national campaign is always picked for its symbolic value. So what brought Ronald Reagan in 1980 to open his presidential campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi? There can only be one thing. The only thing Philadelphia, Mississippi is known for is that's where three young civil rights workers in the summer of 1964 were murdered. They were murdered there. You know, I don't want to just call them the three young civil rights workers. They had names. They were James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner. They came down to that area to help register blacks to vote, and two carloads of Klansmen, yes, members of the Ku Klux Klan, chased them down, beat them, and murdered them, and buried them in an earthen dam. So that's where Ronald Reagan goes to open his presidential campaign. You might say, well, maybe that's not why he went there. Maybe he had another reason. No, sir, you can't get away with that. Because Ronald Reagan, as Bob Herbert noted, drove the crowd wild when he declared, I believe in states' rights. States' rights being one of those code words that Lee Atwater referred to, where since you can't yell N-word, N-word, N-word anymore, you talk about states' rights. This bastard Reagan is Sean Hannity's hero. So how insulting is it to anyone with half a brain, with half an ounce of knowledge of history when Sean Hannity tells his audience that it's the Republican Party that is the pro-African-American party, and it's the Democrats that are the horrible anti-African-American racist party. How absurd! The horrible thing is, a lot of Sean Hannity's audience doesn't know any better. They don't know any history. They take what he says as the truth. I get email after email where people just parrot back at me what Hannity says. I get emails that tell me, oh, you know, you Democrats, you're taking advantage of the African-American community and fooling them. It's the Republicans that are their real friends. Yeah. I always like it when white people tell the African-American community who their leaders and where their who their leaders should be and where their allegiances should lie. 90% of the African-American community votes Democratic because they don't know what's going on. They should listen to Sean Hannity, and then they'll be in better shape, right? I don't think so. So the next time any right-winger you know starts babbling this Sean Hannity garbage about the Civil Rights Party as the Republican Party, you just throw back in their face all these things. You throw back at them Richard Nixon's Southern Strategy. You throw back at them the Dixiecrat Democrats going over to the Republican Party because that's where they'll be. That's where they would feel at home. You throw back at them Lee Atwater. You throw back at them Ronald Reagan declaring, I believe in states' rights in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the three civil rights workers were murdered. You throw back at them all these things and set them straight. Let's go on to our next segment. We're going to talk about income and wealth distribution in the United States. This segment will make your hair stand on end. We'll start off by reading a bit of an article that was buried on page C4 of Wednesday, October 5th's New York Times. In a country where the population was empowered and aware of what was going on, an article like this would bring out the people with the pitchforks and the flaming torches to storm the castle. But in 2005 America, no one even noticed this. But we'll discuss it. The article is by David K. Johnson, who writes wonderful, wonderful articles about the inequities of the U.S. tax system. He writes, after falling for 2 years, the share of income going to the richest slice of Americans, the top tenth of 1%, grew significantly in 2003, while the share going to 99% of Americans fell, tax data released yesterday showed. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, David K. Johnson goes on to tell us, at the same time, the effective income tax rates paid by the top tenth of 1% fell sharply, declining at more than 10 times the rate reduction for middle-class taxpayers, the new report by the Internal Revenue Service showed. End of quote. This tax reduction for the super rich is, of course, the result of Bush's tax cut program, which everyone pointed out disproportionately benefits the rich and the super rich. The Bushians deny it, but these numbers speak for themselves. Here's another outrageous statistic. Quote, the top tenth of 1% had more income in 2003 than the poorest third of taxpayers, a group with 330 times the number of people. This is a sharp change from 1979, when the total income of the poorest third of Americans exceeded that garnered by the top tenth of 1% by 2.5 to 1. End of quote. In other words, the top tenth of 1%, the very richest of the rich, are growing ever richer while the people at the bottom are falling further and further behind. That, of course, is the hallmark of right-wing economics. It's their goal. And, you know, these numbers actually understate the case. David K. Johnson writes, the IRS data tend to understate incomes for those at the very top because of different rules for reporting wages and capital gains, meaning the actual disparity was larger than the official data show. End of quote. My goodness, larger and worse than this. What do the right-wingers have to say about this? David K. Johnson quotes one. Bruce Bartlett, a fiscally conservative Republican tax expert who was writing a book on the tax system, said that he found it remarkable that just 129,000 tax filers pay more than 15% of all federal income taxes. Well, duh. They're making all the money. Of course they're going to pay a good share of the income tax. This brings to mind Rush Limbaugh. He has declared that on his website, there will be a page kept there eternally. Always. It's always going to be up. And what is it? It's some IRS tax data. Rush is never tired of pointing out that the top 10% pay, this was in 2000, it's probably even worse now, the top 10% pay 67% of the federal income tax. And Rush says,
Oh, that's outrageous. That's an example of how the system is working against those who are successful. Blah, blah, blah.
Of course, as in most things, Rush is looking at things out of the wrong end of a telescope. He's thinking with the place where he sits instead of the place that he's supposed to think with. The reason the top 10% pay 67% of the tax is because they earn 43% rather, of the income. So they're paying a little bit more than their share because the tax system is at least slightly progressive at that level. But how the hell are they making 43% of the income? Now, if these income stats aren't bad enough, let's go over to wealth. Wealth is the result of income earned and saved over time. Obviously, those earning huge incomes are going to be able to save more of their wealth. Those earning lesser incomes are going to have to spend more of their wealth for necessities. Over time, wealth inequality is going to be far greater than income inequality, and that's exactly what the case is. Those of you who have been listening regularly to this podcast know that I've said several times that the richest 10% of Americans own 70% of the wealth in this country. 70%. That means 90% of the people have to get by on only 30% of the wealth. Now, the riff I usually give is, what do those 10% want? They already have 70%. Do they want 80%? Do they want 90%? Maybe they want 95%. In fact, maybe they want it all. In fact, why don't we just all sign over all our assets, all our wealth to the top 10%? No more of this class warfare. Let's just do it all. Just do it, get it over with, no more struggling, and then we'll be done with it. They'll have everything, and then we'll depend on their charitable impulses to let us all survive. Believe it or not, there's actually another level to go to here that makes the 10% owning 70% of the wealth seem benign. The analysis I'm about to give you is original with me. You'll hear it and see it nowhere else except in this podcast and on my website. I did vet it, however, with a prominent economist at NYU, and he did say it's an accurate representation of the situation. So you can trust what I'm saying. The numbers this is based on are a little bit older than those in the David K. Johnson article we started with. Since things have gotten worse since then, this analysis will therefore understate a bit how horrible things are. The analysis will go like this. Let's assume there are 100 people who have $100 to split up. No one expects it to be divided perfectly evenly at $1 apiece, but everyone involved expects that there will be at least some basic fairness used in the process that will split up the money. Now, if that money was our economy and the 100 people was our population, this is how it would be divided. One person, one out of 100, would get $38.10. $38.10. Wow. Now you may think, okay, but the other 99 people could still split, you know, $61.90, so they'll at least get close to a buck each or 70 cents or something like that. Well, unfortunately, that's not how it works out. Besides the one person who gets 38 bucks, four people get around $5, five people get around $2, 10 people get a buck and a quarter. So you have there the top 20%, and everyone there is getting at least a buck and a quarter, and one person is getting $38.10. But what happens when you go below that? What happens when you discuss the other 80 people, the 80 people who represent 80% of our population? Well, get a load of this. 20 people get 60 cents each. Another 20 people get 23 cents each. 23 cents! Perfectly evenly division would be a buck. Okay, you don't want a perfectly even division, but this person's getting a quarter of a, you know, an average share of what it should be. This is the kicker, however. 40 people get a half a cent each. They get a half a penny. 40 people get a half a penny. So there you have it. Out of the 100 people, one guy gets 38 bucks. 19 people get 125 bucks each. But then you start getting less than a dollar until you get to the bottom 40% of the people. They get a half a cent each. No wonder all but the top 10%, or maybe 15 or 20%. No wonder everyone else in the country, the vast majority of the people, 70 to 80% of the people, have trouble making ends meet. They don't earn a fair share of the income, and over time, they cannot accumulate any wealth. They have no assets to fall back on if a calamity or a tragedy strikes their family. And of course, they have very little, if nothing, to pass on to their children, and that cycle continues. On the other hand, at the top, people have more than enough money for 100 lifetimes, for 1,000 lifetimes, and they transfer vast sums of wealth, more than the life earnings of other people, they transfer vast sums of wealth to their children, and that cycle perpetuates itself and intensifies also. This is how our economic system, set up by and for, of course, the super rich, they set it up for their own benefit, not for anybody else's. This is how our economic system has distributed the wealth of our country. P.S. to right-wingers. I've had people write into me and say, oh, well, we don't distribute wealth. We earn it in this country. That's how it's gotten. You don't give out all the wealth. I'm using the word distribution in the sort of passive sense. The system operates, and this is how the money winds up being allocated, whose hands it winds up in. Okay, we're not talking about just taking all the wealth and distributing it to people. So this is how our economic system has distributed the wealth of our country. This is so far from any type of fairness or even sustainability as to be laughable. It would be laughable were it not a direct cause of certain segments of our society lacking adequate resources for food, clothing, shelter, medical care, and other necessities, let alone any amenities of a beyond subsistence life. Now, I know I've thrown a lot of numbers at you here, and I've seen them in writing many times. Maybe they make your head swim, or maybe you can understand them and use them well. I don't know. If you want to see them in writing, I think the easiest thing to do is just go to Google and type in U.S. wealth distribution, and you'll see one of the top three or four search results is the page on my Rational Radical website that contains these statistics. I think an understanding of how income and how wealth are distributed in our country is fundamental to being able to effectively debate a right-winger. Because they will never allude to these facts. They won't even admit them. And you have to pound it into the head that this is the way it is. And they're very hard-pressed to justify it once the stark numbers are in their face. Because even a right-winger knows if a few people have almost everything and everyone else has very little, the people with very little are not going to be able to survive. The right-wing law of the jungle philosophy may feel that that's the way it should be. The Darwinian survival of the fittest is their bylaw. But they'll usually be very loath to admit that in a debate. And they will try to tell you your numbers aren't accurate. But these numbers are accurate, and you can use them with full confidence. Okay, that'll about wrap up this podcast of Blast the Right. As always, if you like what you heard, please tell your friends about it. And if they don't know about podcasting, turn them on to it. Also, if you liked what you heard, I have an entire website full of material that you'll find quite interesting and enjoyable to read. It's at www.therationalradical.com. I love getting listener comments. Please write me at rational@adelphia.net. The music that we open with, and that I'll close with about 60 seconds of, is You Razzle Dazzled Them by Bill Jacobs. You can hear this song and more of his music at billjacobs.us. So, until next time, I'll sign off and say I love you all, including all you right-wing pieces of crap.
You gave them the old razzle-dazzle. You razzle-dazzled them. You gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe you were compassionate. Gave them the old hocus-pocus. You misdirected them with 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. You played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them, let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
You gave them the old stay the course. I'm your man. Why?